call the meeting of the Senate Higher Ed Committee to order. Today on the agenda, we have an overview presentation from the University of Minnesota. So today we have with us President Bob Brunix, and I think that he is going to go ahead and get going. And any questions you might have, let me know, committee. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
And welcome to the committee.
Well, it's great to be here, and thanks for the opportunity to present on behalf of the University of Minnesota. Do you want me seated here? Is this where the circular
yep.
target is? Right here.
Yes.
Right? But anyway, I want to thank members of the committee for giving us this opportunity. It may not seem entirely credible to say that I truly have enjoyed my opportunity to meet with members of the House and Senate over my tenure of nearly 9 years as president of the University of Minnesota. So I'm looking forward to an animated discussion this afternoon, and looking forward to working with you and other members of the House and Senate on coming up with a good resolution to Minnesota's future. I know we have some real challenges in front of us, and it's going to take some heavy lifting on all of our parts to really make sure we can move our state forward. I'd like to begin just by thanking some people who are here today who have joined me. First of all, quite a number of students, when I came in, they said they had my back, and I'm really glad to hear that. But we have incredible students at the University of Minnesota, and so you'll see them actively involved in presenting the university's case during this legislative session. We're joined by several regents this afternoon, Regent Rick Beeson, Regent Steve Hunter, and Regent Dallas Bonsack is here, David Larson, Maureen Ramirez, and Regent Simmons. And so I want to thank all of you for being here this afternoon. And I think Regent Ramirez is in the back of me here. I'm also joined by two senior vice presidents of the University of Minnesota, Robert Jones, who is responsible for the university's statewide system responsibilities, and Tom Sullivan, who is the university's provost and senior academic officer.
Well, welcome to all of those folks, too.
Well, good. Thank you. I want to talk to you mainly. I was told you wanted me to give a broad sweep overview of the university's role in Minnesota's system of higher education. I want to take some time to talk about that mission of the University of Minnesota. It's unique in Minnesota. In many ways, it's unique in the country. And I want to spend some time talking about the priorities of the University of Minnesota and what I think is the phenomenal role and impact of the university on Minnesota's economy and quality of life. I'd like to begin. Do we have this thing work? We have slides?
No slides.
No slides.
They have them.
You have the slides. Good. So we're going to use the old method, which is picture this.
We've got color handouts.
good. I wanted to start with the inscription that appears above the pillars at Northrop Auditorium. I visit it nearly every day, walk by the auditorium. It's at the center of the university's mall, the head of the mall. And etched in stone is this statement, founded in faith, that men and women, I should say, are ennobled by understanding, dedicated to the advancement of learning and the search for truth, devoted to the instruction of youth and the welfare of the state. I have never failed to find these words to be absolutely inspirational. The University of Minnesota was founded in 1851, years before we became a state. It was designated in 1862 as a research and land-grant university, and that has very, very special significance in the state of Minnesota and throughout our nation. At that time, in the middle of the Civil War, the Congress and the President of the United States decided that higher education should be a priority for the long-term future of our nation and granted to states tracts of land to really capitalize and support higher education. We're governed by a 12-member Board of Regents, and I think you all know that you have a major role in electing members of the board, and I think you will be exercising that responsibility this spring. This particular inscription that I've mentioned was etched in stone in 1936 in the midst of the Great Depression. But the idea first surfaced in the 1920s. We wanted something at the university that would clearly stand the test of time. And I find it very interesting that in the midst of the Great Depression, people recognized the beauty of human understanding, and they saw a fit to have their devotion to the advancement of knowledge and the public good written into the very center, the very heart, if you will, of the University of Minnesota. There's a statute on the books in Minnesota that defines the responsibilities of different sectors in our higher education system. And this next slide talks about the university's statutory mission, a mission to offer undergraduate, graduate, and professional instruction through the doctoral degree, and shall be the primary state-supported academic agency for research and extension service. I'd like to take you through a quick review of where the university is located in Minnesota. When people talk about the university, they immediately think about the location of the university's main campus, its flagship campus in the Twin Cities area, and often fail to realize that we're scattered and our resources are located across the entire state. So I'd like to spend just a couple of minutes talking about the five campuses of the University of Minnesota and then talk a little bit more about the other parts of the university system that I think make a phenomenal contribution to our state. There are five campuses. To the northwest, we have the University of Minnesota Crookston. Crookston is mostly an undergraduate institution. It is focused on career-oriented learning and a technologically very rich environment. Its long-term mission is focused on rural development and the needs of rural communities. And if you look at the resources on the Crookston campus site, you see that nearly every agency and every organization is devoted to the rural development of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota Duluth serves northern Minnesota. It is a mid-sized comprehensive university. It offers traditional undergraduate degrees as well as professional and graduate programs. It has a very, very strong science profile, and it has particularly important targeted areas in mineral research, natural resources, pharmacy. It has a entry-level medical school that is focused mainly on family and rural practice, regarded as probably one of the best in the United States. And it deals mainly with workforce shortages and workforce challenges in areas of engineering, medicine, and many other fields. The size of the Duluth campus is about 12,000 students, and it's a campus that has enjoyed phenomenal growth in the last 8 to 10 years. The University of Minnesota Morris provides rigorous liberal arts education. It's one of the top liberal arts colleges in the nation. It's located on a 120-year-old campus, and it attracts a very significant number of students who are interested in science, technology, and mathematics. University of Minnesota Rochester has offered educational programs in the greater Rochester area for decades. But in 2006, the university's Board of Regents decided to establish a campus there to better serve the academic and professional needs of southeastern Minnesota. There's a lot of collaboration that involves other parts of our higher education system, including the Minscu institutions in that particular region. This campus has a primary focus on health-related careers with strong partnerships with Mayo Clinic, does put a focus on entry-level science laboratory jobs that are important not only to that region but the entire state. There are other undergraduate and graduate degrees, graduate and professional degrees, but they are offered typically in collaboration with other campuses of the University of Minnesota. Obviously, the largest part of our system is the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus, and I'm going to spend a fair amount of time talking about the Twin Cities campus and what we do. We're a member of something called the American Association of Universities. It's an association of 63 preeminent research universities throughout the United States. We were one of the founding members of AAU. And this is a designation that many, many states covet for their universities, and one that we should be deeply proud of. The Twin Cities campus is one of the most complex campuses in the United States. There are many states that have a research and a land-grant university. In Minnesota, we have combined those, and I think we wisely did so many, many decades ago. And I think that will serve in the long term the interest of our state. We're one of only four campuses nationally with significant programs in agriculture, veterinary medicine, engineering, and medicine. The others are Wisconsin, Florida, Illinois, and Ohio State. And this creates a tremendous strength and comparative advantage for the state of Minnesota to have all of these very significant educational and research emphases in the University of Minnesota. It allows us to come together in very significant ways to address some of the most significant problems that we see in Minnesota, but also around the world. There are a number of advanced centers and institutes that bring people together from across a wide range of academic fields to address very, very serious issues. There's an institute for I'll just give you a couple of examples. Institute for Translational Neuroscience studies the development of the human brain throughout the lifespan. The Institute on the Environment. Minnesota Population Center consults with China on the development of its first census, the first census of being conducted in the next few years. The Center for Transportation Studies, which is, in my judgment, a world leader in smart, intelligent transportation systems. There are many initiatives that deal with healthy foods, healthy lives. There are obesity prevention centers at the University of Minnesota, Center for Bioethics, the Biotechnology Institute, and many others that I could mention. I'd like to give you a sense of the university's budget. In many ways, the university's budget, as I look at it, is one of the most complex budgets in the entire state of Minnesota. I think it's clearly more complex than the average large-scale business in our state. I want to take you through parts of this graph without spending time on every particular slice of it. If you start on the right-hand side of the chart, the gold portion is tuition and fees. The maroon portion is state funding. Those two together represent about 43% of the total of the university's budget. The point I want to make about these two sources is they are the fungible part of the university's budget. That is, we can set priorities with respect to how these funds are spent. And the vast majority of funding at the University of Minnesota, about 57% of our funding, is highly restricted, highly designated. For example, a grant that comes into the University of Minnesota is a contract, essentially, to complete certain work and accomplish certain defined objectives, and money can't be moved from one area to the other it just simply can't be moved because of the contractual obligations we have. The one point I'd like to make about this graph, or another point, is that your funding in the university, which is about 18% of the university's budget, state funding is about 18% of the university's all-funds budget. That amount of money is leveraged in a very extraordinary way. It's leveraged at the tune of $1 to $4.50. So for every dollar you invest in us, we return directly $4.50 of economic activity back to the state of Minnesota. And as I'll mention later, as I share some additional facts and trends with you on the University of Minnesota, that economic activity brings very significant amounts of money from outside the state of Minnesota to our state, creating a great many private jobs, or at least jobs in the private economy and jobs at the University of Minnesota. So I'd like to take a little time talking about this very, very significant and unique aspect of the university's mission, that is our commitment to research, innovation, discovery, and if you will, the commercialization of ideas that lead to economic activity in Minnesota and beyond. One of the most important things to recognize is that much of this money that supports research comes from outside the state. You'll see in this next chart the primary federal agencies that fund the University of Minnesota, but much of this money also comes from philanthropic foundations and through other sources. The one thing that's important to recognize is we are one of the best universities in the country in this area, and it's not boastful to say it, it's just a fact, and I'll share the facts with you. But in just about every single instance, the people who secure these funds on behalf of the University of Minnesota in our state do so by competing against the best minds and the best universities and the best centers of research and innovation in the United States. This is a highly competitive process, and it requires a very it requires very keen attention to maintaining a competitive infrastructure to maintain the university's preeminence in this area. I'd like to share just a couple of examples because it's very, you know, when you talk about $823 million, I'll take you through that in just a few moments. It sounds like a big number. It's very abstract until you get down to talking about what this work actually accomplishes. Historically, for example, a professor by the name of E.W. Davis spent 28 years refining research that led to the development of the taconite industry in Minnesota. And think about what that did to transform the economy of this state. So let me share a couple of quick examples as I proceed through my remarks. There's a person by the name of Camille Ugerbill, who is absolutely a phenomenal professor at the University of Minnesota. He's a professor of medicine, neuroscience, and radiology. And he's the director of a world-class center, perhaps the best center in the world, a center for magnetic resonance research. He's a member of the National Institute of Medicine. He studies human brain connectivity, and he wants to understand how different regions of the brain interact with one another, not a particularly well-understood phenomenon. And he's truly trying to understand these complex relationships in the human brain. He's been recently selected to head up a worldwide study, an international study, to map these complex connections in the human brain. That work is going on here and is being led by Dr. Ugerbill at the University of Minnesota. These studies, I'm convinced, will find the answers to dreaded diseases and conditions like autism, schizophrenia, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, and we could go on and on and on. There's another place at the University of Minnesota called the Nanofabrication Center. And you might say, well, what does that do? It supports the work of 155 university faculty, 8 different departments, but there are 24 different companies and 28 colleges and universities in Minnesota and across the United States and Canada who access this very important work. And when they access it, they actually pay some of the bills because they can leverage the kind of R&D capacity of the university to benefit the private economy of Minnesota and, in some cases, other states and, in the case of Canada, another country. The research grants we get come, as I mentioned a few moments ago, with stipulations. They can fund researchers, graduate students, faculty, because the faculty mostly write these grants, and they can fund specific research equipment. They hardly ever provide funding for construction or remodeling of laboratories. That's a responsibility that we share together, that the state helps us fund, and clearly that we try to support through internal university resources. The next slide gives you this source of sponsored funding, or mostly research funding, at the University of Minnesota. And you can see the largest portions of this graph come from the federal government, the largest one from the National Institutes of Health. Second largest would be other private sources, philanthropic foundations, for example, private businesses in some cases, although that's in a separate slice here. The National Science Foundation is nearly $100 million a year of activity at the University of Minnesota. Your University of Minnesota ranks 10th among the nation's top public and private institutions, research universities, and 8th among the public institutions in the United States today. The university faculty this past year, represented in this particular graph, brought in $823 million. Our budget from the state this year is roughly $590 million. That was a 36% increase over the previous fiscal year. It creates jobs in the state. We estimate that it creates between 26 and 30,000 jobs, most of them in the private economy.
Excuse me, Mr. President, before
yes.
you move on, could you just explain, I noticed that you didn't mention the state and local government, the $54 million here. Could you maybe explain that a little bit more?
I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Some of that is contract research from the state to solve particular problems. For example, we recently received a grant to develop a long-range plan for water resources in the state of Minnesota. But much of it is represented by federal flow-through money. So the money comes to the state with the stipulation that the state will invest it to solve serious problems or significant problems in the state of Minnesota. And much of it has a very strong applied research focus. But if you really track the dollars, you'll find that even many of the state dollars that come to the University of Minnesota flow through the state from the federal government. And in many cases, these are joint ventures where the university will actually work with leading state agencies, DNR, education, human services, health, in writing joint applications. The state may be the main recipient of these funds, and then subcontracts are given to the University of Minnesota to do a lot of the technical work. So there are a lot of stories behind that particular number, but the point that I'd really like to make is this really strong partnership between the university and the state of Minnesota, I think, is a tremendous source of strength and comparative advantage for us, and one that we ought to preserve and strengthen. I've spent a lot of my life working on these state partnerships and my own professional life, and I must say I think we can do much better in this area. We missed on Race to the Top recently. That's one example. I think we need to do a much better job of harnessing the resources we have in public and private institutions in the state in partnership with the state of Minnesota to better leverage these opportunities at the federal level, or in some cases, opportunities that may exist through the World Bank or philanthropic foundations that are targeted on very significant issues of interest to our state, whether it's health care reform, reform of our educational institutions, the preservation of our natural environment. All of these are big issues that I think we can do a better job in by working together to leverage new outside resources. But that's basically what that slice of the pie is all about.
Thank you.
So the Department of Transportation, I was at a meeting yesterday where we talked, and the head of the Commissioner of Transportation was there. And some of the funds that come to the Department of Transportation, they're designated to solve particular problems. They require technical analysis, technical research, and it's more in the form of a partnership than it is a granting of money. Let me move on from here, unless there are other questions. You'll see on the next chart that the organization of colleges and campuses, in terms of securing new federal funding. Public health has been one of the great growth fields at the University of Minnesota. There's a 74% increase in outside funding to the School of Public Health, where we happen to be one of the top schools in the country. 68% in the biological sciences. It gives you a sense for how the priorities are shifting for the funding of research in the United States today. College of Veterinary Medicine went up 51%, medical school 26%. Some of those medical school dollars are tied to a very exciting partnership with Mayo. And you probably saw some recent news on the Mayo University partnership in the last few months. The top schools are the medical school, the College of Science and Engineering, the School of Public Health, the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences, and the College of Education and Human Development. The next slide gives you a sense of the awards trend for sponsored funding or research. And you can see it's very much in the upward direction. Sponsored funding has actually increased about 40% since 2001. And if we track our growth in expenditures in this area in the last 5 years, the university has been among the top three public universities in the United States. This research activity, or at least some of it, produces products and ideas that find their way into Minnesota's economy, or in some cases the economy of other states and maybe even other countries. You have a summary in this next slide of the technology commercialization activity of the University of Minnesota. You can see that the disclosures of are up about 8%. The new licensing agreements are up 50%. Not all of these result in immediate revenues or products or economic activity, but they do really make a material difference in creating an environment of research, discovery, innovation, and obviously partnerships with the private economy in Minnesota. There's been a 30% increase in revenue-generating agreements. Most of the agreements are not blockbusters. You know, some of them have to do with licensing agricultural products or small-scale technologies that could eventually grow into major businesses like Medtronic, a business I think I'd like to say that had its origin at the University of Minnesota. This is an activity that has produced 8 startup companies in this last year. 7 of them were licensed to Minnesota. 1 went to Wisconsin because we didn't have the capacity in Minnesota to support the activity. Our approach when we have a discovery we think has commercial value, it goes through a very rigorous process. Our first approach is to try to locate that technology in a startup company in Minnesota. And when we exhaust our possibilities in Minnesota, we look beyond the state to see if there is some other place that can do a better job than the capacity we may have in our own state. There are some people who would like to argue that we should be able to live off such earnings. It's a little bit like looking at the growth, the development, and the evolution of small businesses. Most of them fail. Not all ideas create huge amounts of money. We happen to have one blockbuster, a pharmaceutical drug. Its license runs out in 2013. But the point I really want to make is this is a major focus of the university. It's vitally important to our economy. It's vitally important to creating the kind of culture of innovation that is going to grow the jobs and the economy of Minnesota's future. But it's not the kind of money you can live on each and every day because it is not particularly predictable from year to year or month to month.
Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. President Brunix, I was, when you just said that, makes a good point as we look at this chart because the amount of gross revenues have varied significantly in the last 5 years here. What brings in more money? For example, 2005 looked to be a banner year for disclosures and new licenses and patents, but the revenue was not nearly as high as it was in 2009. So were they just different types of patents and licenses that generated more revenue, products that were more valuable, or what causes the variation?
Senator Roebling, I think there are a lot of examples. There's always a lagging effect. So you have a disclosure, you license a company, it often takes some years for that company to get enough sort of success and enough of a market share to really make a difference. But there is tremendous variation across products. For example, the pharmaceutical discovery at the University of Minnesota produced nearly $50 million on average over the last several years. I should say what we do with that money is we invest it back, for the most part, in the university's research infrastructure, trying to fund things that we can't easily fund through federal grants or even state support. We develop, for example, a long-term fellowship fund for researchers who work in these various fields across the University of Minnesota. So we've tried to really make investments that have long-term payoff for the University of Minnesota and use it to supplement really critical funding needs to keep the research infrastructure alive. But that's a good example. This is it will be pretty close to a 20-year a revenue stream off this particular discovery. It runs out around 2013 to 2015. And then it gets licensed in a more generic form, and you can't really recoup the same kind of revenues. And so you can see this kind of profile across leading universities. But increasingly in the United States, companies that formerly had their own research operations are looking to get this kind of essential R&D creativity, this research and development creativity, through partnerships with our great research universities or through essentially buying successful companies. So an idea may come out of some laboratory at the university. It may get some legs and be successful in 5 years, and then it gets acquired by Medtronic. Medtronic really acquires this R&D capacity and absorbs it into a much larger corporate entity, and that's increasingly been the trend in the United States over the past 40 to 50 years. It wasn't too long ago when all the great laboratories, or most of them, were located in particular companies, and the best example of that was AT&T, Bell Laboratories. But increasingly, we're seeing this kind of more free market of ideas with a lot of the discoveries coming out of our colleges and universities. Great, there's a fabulous book that's been written by Jonathan Cole entitled The Great American University, which is the great universities in the world are mostly located here in the United States, and we happen to have one of them, which should be an enormous source of pride for our state. And those universities thrive in the United States because of, I think, the freedom our government has given them to push on the development of new ideas. Increasingly, with the Bayh-Dole Act of about 25 years ago, universities can capture some of the benefits of their discoveries and plow them back into the core infrastructure, as we try to do at the University of Minnesota. By giving an example, if we discover Honeycrisp and that gets licensed, and we did, I think it's the best apple in the world, and the successors to Honeycrisp are as good or better. That gets you maybe $1 million a year in revenue if it's highly successful and it gets adopted in New Zealand and Australia and other parts of the world. It's quite different than the funding yields you get from major high-tech discoveries, like software discoveries or pharmaceutical discoveries. I'd like to turn for a few moments to education. The educational enterprise of the University of Minnesota is not often well understood. There are roughly 68,000 students enrolled in various university campuses, the five campuses that I mentioned. The main graduate and professional programs are located in the Twin Cities, Duluth, and Rochester. The Rochester totals are included in the Twin Cities totals. We had 69 doctoral programs ranked recently by the National Research Council, the second highest among participants across the country, and many of the academic programs of the university were very, very highly ranked: aerospace engineering and mechanics, chemical engineering, material science, chemistry, child development, civil engineering, ecology, evolution, and behavior, one of the best programs of its kind in the world, food science, material science and engineering, mechanical, natural resources. These are all fields that have really been highly regarded in these national surveys and evaluations. We're particularly strong in the social sciences, psychology. Minnesota Population Center, for example, has really strong engagement of scholars in psychology and sociology and, in some cases, anthropology and other fields. We've really made an effort in the last 10 years to improve undergraduate education. And many people feel, I'm a 42-year veteran of the University of Minnesota. This is my 42nd year on the faculty and in the administration of the university. And I felt early in my career that we weren't paying enough attention to the undergraduate education of students. That is not true today. It is a really high priority, and the results, I think, are very, very encouraging. In the fall of 2006, we had about 24,000 applications for freshman admission to the Twin Cities campus of the University of Minnesota. It was close to 37,000 this year. There's been a 50% increase in freshman applications to the university, and I know people can now apply to more places with greater ease today than they did at one time. But if you benchmark these application trends against the other leading universities in the country, you'll find our trends are significantly higher than the average of our peer group. The academic preparation of students entering a Twin Cities campus is significantly on an upward curve. 43% of the entering freshmen are in the top 10% of their high school class, compared to 33% about 6 years ago. The average ACT score is about 27, compared to about 24 in 2003. The preparation level, in short, of students who now attend the university's Twin Cities campus and other campuses of the University of Minnesota is clearly on the increase. Last year, we...
Excuse me, President.
Yes.
Senator Saxlock.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. President Brunigs, is there some reason for this? I mean...
Yes, I think there are some very good reasons for this. First of all, I think the University of Minnesota is an incredible value. I think we made some very, very hard choices supported by courageous actions of the Board of Regents to trim our sails. About 6 or 7 years ago, we had a two-year preparatory college that was developed around 70 years ago, called General College. It was a gateway to admission to the University of Minnesota, but it was developed before we had 11 community colleges in the Twin Cities area. And so we felt it was really important to set our priorities and fix our responsibilities for the future of the university and in our state. So I think all of these changes have made a difference, but we have really made the issue of college readiness and college preparation a big deal at the University of Minnesota. And I can't go anywhere in the state and talk to leaders in K-12 education without them telling me, keep it up, because you're helping us do our job at the local level. So we've made the preparation of students a high priority. We've made it a priority to really improve the outcomes, graduation rates, retention, academic achievement, learning, international experiences we think are really important to young people in the modern age. And so this has been a very, very careful attempt to improve, really improve the transition from students, the experience of students who transition from high school or transition from other colleges, mostly two-year colleges. So there's been a really strong effort to improve the quality, but we've also gone out and built partnerships with the K-12 system, with our colleagues in Minscu and other in the private colleges, to really emphasize the importance of getting ready for college, being prepared, taking the right courses. We find that when it comes to predicting college success, if you enroll in the right courses and you study hard and you get decent levels of achievement, your odds of success go up very materially. And so all of that has been part of a very focused strategy in the last 8 to 10 years, and it's really beginning to pay off when you look at the outcomes of the University of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to the enrollment quickly. I see we have about 68,000 students enrolled in all of the systems. How many of those graduated from Minnesota high schools? What percent approximately?
So very good question. I think it's important to track that statistic every year because, unlike many universities, I think it's important for Minnesota's university, its flagship research university, to pay attention to the people in our state. So our percentage of Minnesota students in this undergraduate population is varied roughly from 62 to 65%. It averages about 65%, and it hasn't really changed over this period of time. One of the peculiar things about our enrollment situation, many of you know, is we have reciprocity agreements with other states. And so most of our out-of-state students who come to the university's Twin Cities campus or Duluth or other campuses come under this reciprocity agreement. In fact, on the Twin Cities campus recently, 18% of the out-of-state students that we served were Wisconsin students, and of course many of our very good students go to Madison and other campuses in the Wisconsin system to get their undergraduate education. It's worked relatively well for us. I think one of the challenges going forward is whether states will be able to sustain these kind of reciprocity agreements. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult. Wisconsin now subsidizes students who come to the University of Minnesota. I don't know if they'll keep doing that. You have a tax fight, I understand, about between Minnesota and Wisconsin. We'll see how all that turns out. Higher education seems to be in the crosshairs whenever there's a fight across the borders, and so we may see some impact on the reciprocity agreement. I hope not. It served both states, I think, exceedingly well. My own sense is long-term, we will see a shrinkage of the demography, or at least the college-age student cohort, in these reciprocity states of North and South Dakota and Wisconsin. That, I think, and we will see some decline in some areas of the college-age population in Minnesota, less so than in some of these other states. And I think that's going to make it very, very important. If we want to grow Minnesota's economy and keep our economy strong, we're also going to have to recruit people from other states across the country. We find that when we do that, when they come to the Twin Cities, they study in the Twin Cities or Duluth or one of our other campuses, and I think this is true of the private colleges in particular in Minnesota and some of our other public universities in the Minsky system, that when students come here from elsewhere, they study here, they often stay at very, very high rates and contribute to our economy. We will have to be a net importer of talent in the future, and it makes your question all the more important. We also have to be really good at keeping our most talented people here in the state.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And President Brunix, I was a supporter of the Rochester campus, but I'm looking at this enrollment figure of 143 students and wondering, they're in the undergraduate program, is this for 4 years? Which really makes the classes very small. And how many administrators do we have in Rochester for 143 students?
Well, Chancellor Limkel is here, and he can, along with Chancellor Black from Duluth, and so we might get him up to answer this. But let me just say, if you ask an administrator, do we have enough administrators, they'll usually tell you no. We don't have very many administrators in Rochester. I can't give you the precise number, but the effort in Rochester is to really leverage the resources of other campuses. So give me an example. Chancellor Limkel decided when he was inaugurated that he would, instead of building his own admissions office and financial aid office and all the other sort of administrative offices, he would leverage those resources from the Twin Cities campus. And so we've really made a deliberate attempt to keep Rochester lean and mean. Now, that 143 students is very deceptive. The total enrollment of the campus is in excess of 1,000 if you consider students in part-time graduate programs. Duluth, for example, offers a licensed MBA program in Rochester that is very, very highly subscribed. So the public health has master's degrees there. The College of Science and Engineering has had an electrical engineering degree in the Rochester community, I think, for something like 40 years, if I'm not mistaken. So all of that happens, and if you sort of partition those numbers in terms of location, the enrollment would be larger, but the enrollments are booked to the college and the campus providing the instruction. So Rochester hosts these programs and provides access to people in the region, but the numbers are attributed to the colleges and campuses that actually provide the instruction on site. The other thing I would say is Rochester started some new health-oriented degree programs, and they've only been in operation a couple of years. And so we have it, for every year from now on, that number will keep going up with each new class. And so we expect the enrollments longer term will be much more robust, probably pretty close to 1,000 on a regular basis, plus the other programs that we talked about.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Roebling.
How many years have we been in operation there?
We've been in operation since 1966 in Rochester, but as a campus, just in the last, I think, 3 years, 4 years, we started. Here you are.
Yes.
I mean, you're amazing. But anyway, we started it. I think you were inaugurated in what, 2007?
2007.
Yes. But so the campus has really started in the new health sciences degree.
We have the numbers that you're seeing. My name is Steve. I'm Chancellor, University of Minnesota, Rochester.
Thank you.
The numbers that you see there are students who are exclusively attributed to University of Minnesota Rochester. We're in the second year of a 4-year program. So last year we admitted 50 students. This past fall we've admitted 100 students. Our plan is to admit 150 students the following year. And as the enrollment grows, we will eventually have a freshman class in the Bachelor of Science of Health Science program of 250 students a year. Our focus is in the health sciences. It's a program that's designed to be a springboard to a wide variety of health-related careers. In terms of the number of students that are on our campus that we touch in some ways, we would give you a number of probably about 530, because that captures all the students who are taking courses in education, in social work, in clinical lab science, which is a program that's offered. They have half the students in the Twin Cities and the other half the students down in Rochester. We have occupational therapy. So there's a host of, if you count, there's like 30 different kinds of programs that we create access to. So students in the Southeast Minnesota region can receive that instruction from the University of Minnesota without leaving Minnesota.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Roebling.
Could you answer the question about the number of administrators?
Sorry.
About the number of administrators?
The number of administrators. We have a staff, total staff now, roughly 70, and that's faculty and administrators. And I would probably, I'd have to go back and count, but I would say we probably have about 20, what you would fall in the category of administrators. I can provide you that list. And what we will do each in successive years is our hiring plans is that we are hiring faculty we have hiring going on for the next year's class, which will be the junior class. And so all the hiring that we're making going forward now is in faculty positions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I am a little dumbfounded, though, with 143 of your own full-time students and 70 total staff. That's quite a
Our Student Affairs Office is one example. And again, we have 550 students, so we're providing access. We provide the student support services for that full range of students. We have what we call program directors who are providing the student support services for this clinical lab science, for the social work programs, and so on. So it's not just the 143 that we're providing administrative support for. It's for the 530 students that we serve on that campus.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Senator Roebling.
Thank you. And at some point, I would like to get some figures as to what the system is subsidizing this campus at right now, because obviously your revenue generation with that low number of students is requiring quite a subsidy from the system somewhere.
Happy to provide that information.
I should say, though,
Thank
Senator Roebling.
Yes,
Bernix. I should say that the subsidy there's a special appropriation from the state legislature that occurred some years ago. And I would say the city of Rochester has been extraordinary in supporting this campus. I think you have to view this campus as a startup, basically. And in the early years, it takes some additional resources to get things on, up and running and get the academic programs in place. And I'm absolutely convinced that the subsidy that I believe is relatively modest will continue to go down, but we certainly can get you the numbers. They're publicly available, and we keep a sharp eye on them, and we have a real strong plan to narrow the gap between the revenues of that campus and the support that it receives from Central University resources. And that's true of every campus. We expect our campuses to be economically vibrant. We don't expect them to depend on a lot of life support investments. They need to earn their way. And the amount of money we put into them should be relatively modest and not out of proportion to what they produce. So I would just say, though, this is a, you know, you've got two classes that have been admitted, right? And so this is very much in the early stages, and we expect this is going to be a campus that will have a real focus on health and health-related professions, and then supplemented by other degree programs in laboratory science and other fields that are essential to that region of the state and, I think, to the entire state of Minnesota. But we will not have a football team. That was the agreement. And a lot of other expensive things. It's going to be an academically oriented institution without a strong entertainment business. And so I have a feeling that it'll be economically very strong and viable in the future, or otherwise I don't think we would have taken a chance to develop a campus in this environment.
Well, President Bernice, you mentioned that you could provide us with some numbers.
Yeah,
I'd
be happy
that,
to do it.
Most members of the committee would be appreciative.
I'd like to combine it also.
If you would actually provide those.
Yeah, we'll do that, but I'd like to put it in the context, too, of the campus's strategic plan and direction, so you get a context for what these numbers mean and how they'll evolve.
If we could just get the numbers, we'd appreciate it.
Good. We'll do that.
Thank you.
Let me take a little time to talk about degrees. You see about 14,500 degrees were granted in the University of Minnesota campuses. I don't need to go through these at great length, but I do want to make a couple of points that the university academic programs produce a large proportion of the degrees in the state of Minnesota in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Close to 40% of the undergraduate degrees, about 75% of the master's degrees in this area, and close to 90-plus percent of the doctoral degrees. And many of these degrees, or people with these degrees, go into the high-tech businesses of Minnesota. And if you go down the halls at 3M, for example, and you visit the laboratories, you will find a very high representation of scientists who have degrees from the University of Minnesota. I would also argue that about 85% of the practicing doctors in Minnesota have University of Minnesota degrees. 90-plus percent of the veterinary medicine specialists in our state who have earned a good living off some of my habits of owning animals have their degrees from the University of Minnesota. So the point I'm really trying to make is this is an academic profile that is really related to the private economy and to Minnesota's core infrastructure, particularly in the science-related areas and health sciences. I won't spend a lot of time on this, the next set of slides, but I do want to just share with you that I think the indicators at the University of Minnesota, the ones that really count, are all going up, and they're all going up at very rapid rates. Four-year graduation rates have close to doubled, I think more than doubled in the last few years. Student satisfaction rates of graduates and entering freshmen are at an all-time high, pretty close to 85-90%. We have done a phenomenal job in this very, very difficult environment in the last 8 to 9 years to keep higher education accessible and affordable, and you might look at me with some puzzlement and say, how can that happen? Because tuition has gone up on public campuses across the United States, including the University of Minnesota. That story is one of the best stories at the University of Minnesota. If you look on a graph that is entitled, it's a few pages into the slideshow, Commitment to Student Financial Support, I want to share with you some things that have happened at the university that I'm deeply proud of to keep higher education financially accessible and affordable. I'm not sure if this slide has a number, but if you can find it, it's called Commitment to Student Financial Support.
It's 18. It's page 18.
Page 18 in your slides. Some years ago, we recognized at the University of Minnesota that state budgets were in trouble, We took a close to $200 million cut in the 2003-2004 period on the university's base budget over a two-year period. There are some members of the committee who remember that very well, and it was an extremely painful period of time. So I recognized, along with the board and the university community, that we needed to do some very heavy lifting at the University of Minnesota to drive down costs, control costs, but also to raise private sources of funding and to allocate internal sources of funding to support our students. We started something called the Promise for Tomorrow Scholarship. We went out all over the country, met with our graduates, and said it was time to give back. It was time to really make sure that young people and working adults had the same opportunity they had. We were raising about $5 to $7 million a year in scholarships. We put a matching program together, and over roughly a six-year period of time, raised close to $320 million, doubled the number of scholarships, doubled the size of awards, and created something we call the University of Minnesota Promise Program. This is a need-based scholarship program for Minnesota students that now supports 13,000 low and moderate, or students from low and moderate income families in the state of Minnesota. I think it's the finest program you will find in a public or private institution anywhere in America today. That particular need-based program provides nearly full funding for students whose families have zero expected ability to help the students succeed in our colleges and universities, up to a smaller grant for students who come from adjusted gross income families of about $100,000 a year. It's a very, very fine program. We spend more through private sources and our internal support to help our students succeed and cover their bills than the combined total of state and federal support. We spend about $75 million a year through these private and internal university sources. It's allowed us to keep the net price increase, the annual net price increase for undergraduate Minnesota residents to about 3% a year. Students still borrow. They have to. Those borrowing rates are roughly about $20,000 a year by the time they graduate. I don't think this is a good trend. I think it's something you can manage as an undergraduate student, but if you go to medical school and you start borrowing money to go to medical school or dental school, these numbers get to be very, very high. And I think long-term, our country has to start to deal with these very significant issues if we want to be competitive in the global economy. I'd like to spend just a few moments on the third part of the university's mission, and that's the mission we have for public engagement and outreach. I mentioned the Land Grant Act of 1862, designating the university as a university or a higher education entity with extraordinary responsibilities to really extend the reach of research, innovation, and education to the needs of Minnesota communities. What you see on this map, it says University of Minnesota
Excuse
statewide
me, Mr.
presence.
President.
Yes.
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. President. Sorry to
no problem.
Jump back for a second to the Promise Scholarship. Where does that money come from?
Senator Fischbach, Senator Latz, it comes from basically two sources. A very significant source is private funding. There are donors that have given significant amounts of money and even small gifts that we put into scholarship endowments that are designated for students who come from families that have very modest economic means or economic capacity. The second is that we have reallocated our own internal resources. Some of it comes from tuition dollars and some from our other sources of support at the University of Minnesota. So it's, we try to put this together in a very coherent way from a variety of sources, but increasingly I would love to see the entire program supported by outside, that is privately funded sources, but it takes some time to develop that capacity.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Mr. President, could you tell me approximate proportions? How much is private funding? How much is?
I don't have that right off the top. I don't have that right off the top of my head, but we could certainly put those numbers together. I would say most of it right now is internally funded for the University of Minnesota Promise Scholarship. Probably a third of it comes from private sources. That would be my best estimate without actually seeing the actual numbers. But our goal, strategic goal over time, is to make sure that any increase in that fund is supported as much as possible by private sources of support.
Senator Lansing.
Chair, just a comment. To the extent it's tuition, it's other students subsidizing it, which is, I think is not a healthy model, maybe a necessary one given levels of state support, but I don't think it's a healthy model. It just obscures the level of funding or the sources of funding. I'm not saying that in a bad way, but in terms of accountability and in terms of our policy judgments and funding level decisions here. And to the extent it's a private funding, that's really more of a private college model than a public university model, which I think is a very unfortunate trend.
Senator Ladd.
Necessary, I understand, but still not a pleasant one.
President Brunix.
I appreciate your comments, but I think increasingly in this world we're going to have to manage some very complex dilemmas. I'm a first-generation college student, and I earned my way through a college education and paid back my debts, and I understand that reality very well. I think as a matter of public good, we ought to do everything possible as a society to keep higher education financially accessible for people who have average means. I would prefer that that be funded publicly with some support from private resources. But you have, I think, aptly pointed out that this historic trend when it comes to funding the University of Minnesota and other public universities across the country, in our state across the country, has moved us increasingly into a private financing model. 70% of the students who get four-year college degrees in the United States are going to public universities right now. And increasingly, those pressures, as states have, you know, they've done a study recently, the Association of Public Land Grant Universities, which documents these trends over the last 30 years. And as states have felt the squeeze of healthcare cost increases and economic adjustments that they've had to deal with, a lot of that has come at the expense of funding our public institutions, and that has increased tuition. So there's no question in my mind that public universities are moving more and more to a private financing model. I don't think that's particularly good, and that's why I feel so strongly about making sure that the University of Minnesota and other universities like ours have funding strategies for students of modest means. You know, you just if you neglect that kind of responsibility, you're denying the benefits of higher education to people who have real possibilities of leveraging the American dream if they only have the opportunity to attend one of our colleges and universities. And so I think it's a trade-off that is very much in the interest of our students, very much in the interest of the university, but it's not one that I relish. Now, I will say that I do think that something matters to you more if you contribute something to the outcome. I happen to feel that very, very strongly. I think that holds down healthcare costs. I think it helps students pay attention to their studies and work harder for their degrees. So I do think there has to be an individual responsibility here and an individual component when it comes to financing the education of our students and the education of people who go on to study at the post-baccalaureate level. It's finding that right balancing point that I think is giving us some difficulty, particularly in the depths of this very, very deep recession that we're in.
Senator Lance, you have a follow-up?
Just a final follow-up, if I might. You mentioned at the beginning of your presentation that the state of Minnesota's contribution is now about 18% of your all-funds budget. Do you have any trend information on that?
Oh, yes.
What was it 10 years ago? What was it 25 years ago?
10 years ago would have been closer fifths to 30%. Pretty close to 30%. It wasn't too long ago, if you took the combination of tuition and state funding, the state had about 70% of the cost of education, and tuition covered about 30%. Those numbers have really switched now in the last several years, so that about 54% of the funding of education now comes from tuition dollars, and about 46% of the funding from the state. So the state puts 18% into the University of Minnesota for its research infrastructure, special appropriations that govern extension and research centers across the state, the education of our students. Tuition provides 22% of the university's budget right now, so you can see these lines have crossed, and increasingly we are moving to a private funding model. I don't think that's healthy for the state in the long term. I think we have to find the right balance here, I think we all have some responsibility. We have to really drive down the cost of education. You talk about having too many administrators. I can give you a long list of administrators who no longer have titles at the University of Minnesota. We've combined colleges. We've reduced administrative costs, administrative overhead. There'll be a finite limit to how much we can squeeze out of the university. But we believe it's our responsibility when we have economic challenges to take about two-thirds of the economic challenge on the cost side and only look to revenue increases, mostly tuition, to solve the other third. But I will tell you that if Minnesota wants to continue to be a state with low unemployment, a state with vibrant industries that can compete in the 21st century, we're going to have to take a hard look at this. Higher education is going to have to be a priority. It can't be in the back room. It can't be way down the list of priorities. In the global economy, or knowledge and human capital, that is where the education of our students are going to be the critical difference in growing jobs in Minnesota's economy and creating this and maintaining this great quality of life we have. We're going to have to pay attention to these issues. We have to get through this tough patch. There's no question about it. But I think it's going to take creative financing strategies like the University of Minnesota Promise Scholarship. 13,000 students who would have been in jeopardy in terms of attending the University of Minnesota from our state now access this scholarship, which can be combined with Pell Grants and state grants and other private scholarships they get. And it's the critical difference between being able to go to college, finish on time, or finish on a timely basis and pursue your dreams, or perhaps not having that opportunity. There is a cross-subsidy, you might argue, a modest one from people who come from higher-income backgrounds. I think that's not a bad deal because they are still getting an incredible bargain by attending the University of Minnesota. But that's a small part of what goes into the University of Minnesota Promise Scholarship. And our promise is to try to make sure that we find other sources of revenue over some period of time. But I think in this critical period, we've got to make sure there is a very, very strong need-based approach to funding students, and that's one of the reasons I've been such an advocate for the University of Minnesota Promise Scholarship, and will be pursuing these ideas long into the future, I hope.
President Burns, I have a few more senators with questions, and we've got about 20 minutes, so I just want to make sure that everybody's questions get answers. Senator Roebling, I believe you had a question.
Thank you. When we were talking about the private funding and the endowments, and I'm just wondering about the revenue that you're receiving from endowments now because of the lower interest rates. Has that significantly affected the amount of scholarship money that you have available?
Senator Fischbach and Senator Roebling, it has had some impact. We did have a payout, for example, from endowments of 5%. It's now down to 4.5%, and I think it will trend downward from even 4.5%. Because what we have an obligation, if someone gives us a long-term commitment, long-term financial commitment, to protect that core and to make sure that it keeps up with inflation. So it's had some impact, but it hasn't been a great impact because we've been able to increase private funding. In fact, scholarship support in this at the end of this calendar year was really up. And I think there are a lot of people in our society that recognize that young people are struggling more than they were. They had the GI Bill or they had some other possibilities. Costs were much lower in previous decades. And so I think people are willing to give back. But there's no question that the economy, we all took a hit, you know, in the value of our endowments. The University of Minnesota did better than most institutions of higher education in investing prudently to make sure that we didn't suffer the kinds of losses that were reported at Harvard and some other places. But, you know, our endowments took a hit. They're coming back, obviously, with the strength of the market and other resources, I mean other sectors in the economy. And private giving has been, even in this recession, been relatively robust. The point I want to make about private giving, though, it's not a core solution to the university's budget. It funds roughly about 7% of the budget of the university, and it mostly goes to retaining very, very talented faculty, supporting students, sometimes putting money into core infrastructure. For example, we have a one-third debt responsibility on buildings that if we get support from the state, we go out and try to raise private funding to help with some of that. So it's not a big source of funding in the university's budget, but it's that critical extraordinary edge, if you do it right, that allows you to really engage people, donors that really feel strongly about the future of the university and what the university tries to do. And it provides that sort of critical difference you need to keep your very best people and to attract and support strong students. And so it's going to be a way of life. It will be an increasing part of the university's budget over some period of time, but it'll be a long, long time before any endowment at the university can pay the general bills. It just doesn't happen. Practically every gift we get is designated for a particular purpose. So somebody gives a gift in the arts for a scholarship, it goes to a scholarship commitment. No one else can sort of move it from that commitment to some other area of the university. About 95% of the gifts we get are restricted in that sense.
Senator Sharon?
Thank you, Chair. President Brunig, I have a million questions, but I'll go to my most critical one. And that is that I really believe we need to have a retreat and a conversation statewide about what we expect out of higher educational systems like we did with health care reform, and that I hope that there will be initiatives to make that happen and that we fund it like we did health care reform. But there's a limitation to what the legislature can require the university or the Minsky system, but it certainly would help the Minsky system. And one of those things that would be in that dialogue is changes in the way in which we pay for higher education in order to make sure that the method of payment isn't driving an outcome that's different than what might be in the best interest of the people who are paying for the system. So specifically, my question is, and I'm thinking about this in terms of the whole system, that you're reporting that your Twin Cities campus freshmen have average ACT composite in high school ranking that is increasing substantially. You also have these wonderful improvements in your graduation rates that sort of correlate with that. If I look at those graphs next to each other, so even though you have much support for people of limited means to come into the system, they are also probably meeting these higher rankings in terms of where they rank for graduation at their schools and their ACTP composite. And I think it's great. I'm not being critical about that. But in terms of thinking of the overall system, there is a relation. Do you think there's a relationship between your success and graduation rates and that graph?
Which graph? The graduation?
Which shows your increased ACT score composites and your high school graduation rank.
There's no question that the University of Minnesota is somewhat more selective today. You know, if you have 37,000 applications for freshman admission. They don't all intend maybe to come to the Twin Cities campus, but we accept about 5,200. We tried to increase certain fields. And so that really encourages students to get better prepared, to take the most rigorous courses, to work really hard so they can be competitive in their application. I happen to think that that's not elitist. I think that's a good thing. It encourages young people to work hard and make good choices when they're getting prepared to make out those college applications. With respect to how you fund higher education, I don't think you can hold this retreat, and I think it's a good thing. But I don't think you can fund higher education in some uniform, simple way, because in your own statutes, you require different things of different sectors of higher education. I think it is absolutely critical when it comes to the University of Minnesota that you maintain the research infrastructure of the university. It's one of the most important competitive advantages this state has in the global economy. In fact, there are a number of economists that will argue that having a strong research university in the middle of your state or in your region is perhaps the most important competitive advantage you can have in the global economy. So I don't think you can fund a community college with sort of the same sort of formula and strategy that you fund the University of Minnesota, but I think both of them are vitally important to this state's future. The question is, do we have the sort of right mix? Do we have are they in the right places? Are they productive enough to warrant long-term investment? These are hard questions. They go to the heart of the values of community and the values of our state. But I do think we are reaching very quickly a point where we're going to have to set, first of all, I'd say make higher education a priority and make sure higher education has priorities that deserve the public attention and deserve public support. So I don't know if it's going to come out of a retreat or out of a study commission, but I do think it's inevitable we're going to reach the point in Minnesota of grappling with decreasing resources and the need to really protect what's important for the long-term future of our state. And it's going to require some very tough priorities. I don't believe you can have economic challenge, serious loss of revenues, a state budget deficit, and find your way to a more creative future without setting priorities. It just can't be done.
Let me just follow up.
Yeah,
make
that's
sure
a really
that you're
tough thing for you, but I think it's something we have to think about.
And I agree with that. That's the one of the things that we've discussed in the legislature that we're very interested in, is in decreasing the time it takes somebody to graduate and to get to the degree and to get into the economy as a participant with lower debt, so that they can, you know, experience the fruits of their labor sooner. So what I'm thinking about is your average ACT composite in high school ranks as they increase. I'm wondering if there's a correlation between that and your ability to graduate the students more rapidly.
Absolutely.
And what, which I think is good, and I'm not being critical about that, but it has an implication for the other system then, and how we interpret and understand this difficulties that they're having to deal with and what their need for revenue and resources is in order to help people with lower ACT composites and lower high school rank, maybe never having, not only not having resources, but also have these other difficulties trying to move through and get educated to be able to work in the new economy.
And President Brunix, I've got three senators who have questions in 11 minutes, so
I really like to get into this one because because part of the academic, I won't spend much time on it, but part of the academic challenge we have is when you're talking about degree programs in chemical engineering and material science, they just simply cost more too. So I don't think there's a simple cost equation that you can link to ACT scores. I would really argue that ACT is kind of an interesting indicator. It's important. We look at it and so forth. But the most powerful predictors of whether young people are going to be ready for the rigors of higher education have to do with the selection of the courses they take in high school and their level of academic achievement. They are much more predictive of persistence and graduation than ACT, SAT, and other measures of that kind.
Have done the work.
And so that's why I think college readiness and making that the new standard for the 21st century is really important. And I think we could do some very creative things with the high schools in our state to really address ways to make it easier for students to graduate on a timely basis. For example, the average student coming into Twin Cities campus has 28 credits of advanced placement or college in the schools or post-secondary options, and we need to find ways to better leverage that preparation to drive down costs for students and families, to accelerate their progress, or to give them new academic opportunities. Those are some really creative things that I think we should think about. We better get to the other questions. So.
And now, actually, I have four senators.
Yeah, right.
In 10 minutes.
Yeah, I need to
Senator
keep my mouth shut.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just ask one question as well. Mr. President, I think everyone would appreciate your comments about trying to develop a strategy for students with modest means. I was curious, in that process of the development of that strategy, do you involve other folks on the campus, like faculty and staff, in that strategy? What type of input have you gotten from the faculty, for example? Have they offered any solutions for that strategy?
Yes.
President Bernie.
Senator Fischbach, Representative Patterson, we really work hard as a community to come to consensus on these issues. And, you know, in some ways university environments are not very well understood, but they're highly interactive, they're highly deliberative environments. And every single policy that and every discussion we have involves bringing people to consensus around these long-term directions. And then the best of ideas that have to do with the policy framework of the university have to go through the Board of Regents. So there's very, very high levels of faculty engagement. I meet at 7:30 in the morning with the leaders of all the Senate committees, faculty Senate committees, for example, tomorrow to talk about a whole range of things, including the university's budget, its academic programs, and that kind of work goes on each and every day. We happen to have a culture at the University of Minnesota that's perhaps more engaged in that sense and more inclusive than I think you'll find in most other parts of the country. But it's a very important part of who we are and what we do and what I believe makes us a successful university.
You know, one idea that is not new, and I am just reminded of it because I heard from a constituent on this today. I mean, would you consider asking, you know, your faculty that have PhDs to maybe teach one more class for a period of time?
Well, we have regularly asked them to take on additional loads. We've frozen their salaries. We've reduced their benefits. We're going to have to continue to look at all of those options. But we regularly look at workload issues, and when it's appropriate to do so, we do ask people to take on additional responsibilities. I don't think that formula is going to be just sort of across the board. You've got people who have major NSF grants or NIH grants. If they're in medical school, they've got patients to serve, and so we'll have a variety of strategies. But I can tell you,
thank you, President Bruce.
Being accountable for workload is a very serious priority at the university, particularly in these economic times.
Thank you. I have Senator Brown now.
Yes, Madam Chair, Mr. President. Last year's legislature made cuts to the general fund that affected the University of Minnesota. If these funding numbers continue with no increase in this biennium's budget, how will your institution respond?
Senator Fischbach, Senator Brown, will respond the same way we have in the past, with a real attention to setting the most important priorities that we think will strengthen and preserve the university. We will take two-thirds of the burden and we'll put it, at least as long as I'm president, and that's only about five more months, we'll put two-thirds of the burden on cost reductions and deferring investment. And we've done that with capital investment, academic investment, with reducing expenditures. It's a really good story at the University of Minnesota. I'm not sure how far we can push this, but we have really pushed the envelope pretty hard at the university. And we will try to do everything possible to keep the tuition burden on our students at a very modest level. This is not the time to be passing double-digit increases in tuition. That's about what I can tell you. We've made a real effort. There are three big cost drivers at the University of Minnesota. It goes to the workload question that I was just asked by Senator Pedersen. They're people. About 65 cents of every dollar spent on a person, his or her employment, capital investments. So we put more and more of our money into renewing our facilities as opposed to building new ones. In some cases, canceling large capital projects or at least deferring them. And then student financial aid. We've gone after private funding. The fourth area would have to be, the third area would have to be technology. We've really undertaken some very important initiatives that I think are driving down the cost at the same time we increase the capacity, our technological capacity. So we're really, we're cost hawks, if you will, at the University of Minnesota. And that doesn't mean that we get everything right, but we're really paying attention to how the money is spent and what kind of yield we get for the investments we make. But you still have to invest. We will not be able to cut ourselves to the future. We're going to have to make difficult decisions, set priorities, and I know we're going to have to do more of that in the near term than I hope we will in the long term. But I would urge you to be thinking about the things you need to do to preserve the strength of Minnesota's higher education system. Its entire education system really matters. But I think there's much more attention, I think, to the needs of K-12 than there has been in higher education in recent years. And I would say both deserve our attention if we're going to build the kind of state we're going to be proud of 10 to 15 years from now.
Senator Pappas.
Well, Madam Chair, those are almost good words to end on. But since we have three more minutes, Senator Sharon had asked, President Brunick, Senator Sharon had asked about partnerships or relationships with MinSCU. And could you tell us what's going on with the partnership with the two-year colleges? Is that operational now?
President Brunick.
Yeah, Senator Sharon, Senator Pappas, yes, we have a lot of things, I think, to be proud of with the four-year campuses, public and private, and the two-year campuses. We've developed the Minnesota Transfer Curriculum.
That's what I'm talking about.
We've really integrated technology in ways that I think really serve students and families. There are many, many partnerships. I know at Dakota County we have a major partnership that links an NSF grant.
Madam Chair, perhaps my question was too broad. President Brunick, it's just that I had read that you are accepting any student to the University of Minnesota that gets an associate degree at a two-year college. Is that true, or did I misread something?
No, I don't know that it's any student, but we admit over 2,000 students a year, and most of them come from two-year colleges. That is the transfer students. Some transfer from four-year colleges elsewhere around the country or in our own state, public or private. And some of our students from different campuses transfer to other institutions. So there's kind of a movement of students, but not a great deal. But we've kept our transfer rates up. If you look at other Big Ten universities, for example, the University of Minnesota's Twin Cities campus accepts more transfer students than would be true of other campuses like us around the country. There's always a debate about that since you have 37,000 freshman applications, but I think it's important that we keep those points of access open for people in the two-year college system. It's one of the great – we have a fabulous two-year college system in this state. We ought to be really proud of it. And we find that when students are well-prepared and take that transfer curriculum and achieve at pretty high levels – they have very good graduation possibilities on campuses of the University of Minnesota. And it's one of the ways you can drive down the cost of education. So we do a lot of work, on issues of preparation standards, transfer. We built a transfer office on our campuses to make sure we can ease these transitions and help students be more successful in making a successful transition to the university, or university campuses. But one time we used to keep a catalog of all the partnerships. For example, there's a common e-learning website that Minsku and the University of Minnesota put, the Learning Commons website. We post our classes, on this website. People can, access it in ways, and so it saved a lot of money for the various systems, and it also makes it much easier for us to work together. And so I think we have to continue to challenge ourselves to find academic partnerships and academic synergies that will drive down costs and produce results for the state of Minnesota.
Any follow-up, Senator Pappas?
No.
Senator Miller.
Real quick, thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I just want to thank the students for being here today. We appreciate you guys taking time out of your busy schedule and getting involved in this process. So thank you for that. And Mr. President, I have a comment, and it's going to turn into a comment rather than a question because of time here. But I was back home over the weekend, and there's been a lot of talk with my constituents back home and a lot of talk up here at the Capitol. You're talking about cutting back on expenses. You've talked about administration cutting back, but yet the university hired a new president to take your role at a significantly higher rate, and I just want to share those concerns of my constituents, some folks up here in St. Paul, and myself. So I don't know if you want to comment on that. I think in the matter of time, we probably can't. But I just want to share those concerns, and thank you for the presentation, and we look forward to working together with the University of Minnesota.
Yeah, if I could just say one
President
comment.
President Brunix.
Senator Fishback, let me just make a quick comment about that. I can't comment on somebody else's salary, but it's roughly comparable in terms of total compensation to the adjustment I had in my last contract, as far as I know. There are other people here who could comment on more depth if you're interested in their perspective. But let me just say that the new president of the University of Minnesota, by my calculation, is roughly at the midpoint of the Big Ten. And I do believe that in today's world, we shouldn't be paying outrageous salaries to people who are in leadership positions, particularly public leadership positions. But we also need to be competitive if we're going to get really good people and entrust those people with running, in my judgment, the most complex organization in this entire state. If you look at the flow of money, if you look at the types of responsibilities the university has, it is a very, very complex operation. And I know it's difficult in these times to understand some of the compensation levels. I think we need to keep an eye on them, to be honest with you. I'm more concerned about the rising cost of hiring certain coaches than I am about the import of your question. But I just think that someone who runs a $3.5 billion is responsible for 85,000 people across the state of Minnesota, some of the most complex responsibilities that you can imagine in this world, and a $3.5 billion annual budget should be paid respectfully and at a competitive level. And I think we ought to have some healthy debates about these issues in our state and in our society, but I also think even if you cut that back to what your constituents think should be the right level, it wouldn't even begin to solve any kind of budgetary problem at the University of Minnesota. So I happen to feel that the Regents got this right. It's fair. It's not extravagant. It's in keeping with the marketplace. But I think it's fair game for people to raise questions about academic priorities and budget priorities at the University of Minnesota. We ought to be prepared to answer them.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, President Brunix. We appreciate it. We're about four minutes over, but...
if you would, for me, take a look at some of the rest of the slides. I tried to indicate something on the university's public mission and the location of our resources across the state of Minnesota. We're located in about 45 different places. Our extension offices, our research and outreach centers are in very pivotal places in our state and really make a huge impact or create a huge impact on our economy, our regional economy, and our quality of life.
Thank you.
Anyway,
very
thanks
much.
For the time. It's yep. been Thank great you. To be with you.
And our next meeting is Monday, January 24th, here in room 107 at 3 o'clock, and we'll be going. We'll be having an overview of the MNSCU program system. So, thank you very much, and we are adjourned.
Back in 2003. That's right. They reorganized it all. But they have not been increased.
How are you doing?
Partly it's if you increase them, the university just